in this age of religious and political polarization, and I am grateful to him that he has made himself available to be here with us tonight for our inaugural Lyceum lecture. The Reverend Dr. Forrest Church.
Thank you all so very, very much. Thank you, Alan, for those kind words. Thank you, Greg, for your hospitality. Thank all of you for being here this stormy and snowy night. What a privilege it is to speak not only to you, but in this spot. This is truly the very definition of sacred space. It's such an extraordinary worship chamber. It's magnificent, and I'm humbled and honored to be here. When Alan asked me to come, I asked him what I should talk about, and he reminded me that this would be the evening after the inaugural address. And so we decided that perhaps religion and politics would be a reasonable topic to address, since it would be something that would be on most of our minds. So I'm going to do that, and then when I finish doing that, we'll have a chance to chat together, and you can bring me your perspectives and your questions. It was a cold late winter's Saturday, the sky a canopy of gray clouds matching the spirit of the times, when 100,000 Americans gathered on March 4th, 1933, to hear the new president, a crowd extending from the steps of Washington's Capitol, far into the distance around the reflecting pool and down the Great Mall, times were darker than they are today. Near the bottom of the deepest depression in its history, America had fallen precipitously from the high-stepping days of the Roaring Twenties. The boom had gone bust. One quarter of the population could find no work. Soup lines wound around entire city blocks, and shanty towns turned parks into slums. Yesterday's rich young men, if not actually jumping from Wall Street office windows, were cast into bankruptcy. People turned against their neighbors, looking for scapegoats, driven to violence, at times by desperation. The government appeared paralyzed, and indeed nothing Washington tried seemed to work. The whole fabric of society was unraveling before a helpless nation's very eyes. Though he had shown little over an honorable yet unspectacular public career to indicate that he had the stuff to reverse the nation's fortunes, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our new president, put his finger on the problem. He didn't talk about how the government could work with business and labor to lift us out of the depression or propose any radical social or economic program. The New Deal would come later. What the new president did was to utter the hitherto unspoken word that lurked in everyone's heart, fear. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he said. No other presidential address matches Roosevelt's first inaugural in the directness and immediacy of its impact. At the end of the speech, witnesses say, the applause was thunderous, rolling like waves. The president clapped in rhythm with the crowd. To the millions more listening on radio, the effect was perhaps even greater, more intimately felt, almost personal, as if he were speaking to each American individually. Any speech can be heard. This one, the audience actually lived. Our president's confidence, and this, I believe, is no exaggeration, became the nation's own. In the morning papers, the press, hardened and skeptical as it is today, reflected the relief and exultation of a weary people. Even pundits who faulted the text on political grounds applauded its tone. No more vital utterance was ever made by a president of the United States, read an editorial in the Atlantic Constitution. Confidence literally arose from its hiding place and is today a living reality, another journalist wrote. By saying what he did, when he did, and in the way he did, Roosevelt gave heart to an entire country. I serve on the board of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Institute, which is a non-for-profit foundation dedicated to the Roosevelt legacy. So yesterday, as I was listening to President Bush's words, of course, I had President Roosevelt's, somewhat unfairly to President Bush, echoing in my ears. Among the duties that I have for this foundation is to chair the committee that presents the Roosevelt Four Freedom Medals to men and women whose distinguished voice today carries on the Roosevelt spirit, all the more important in a time when such things as Social Security are in jeopardy. The Four Freedom Medals harken back to FDR's second immortal speech, his annual address to Congress, delivered on January 6, 1941, familiarly known as the Four Freedoms Address. The Four Freedoms Address, along with the Gettysburg Address, was read at the anniversary of the 9/11 tragedy by the governor of New York in New York City. In the Four Freedoms Address, President Roosevelt proclaimed four basic freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. These freedoms demand our protection and extension everywhere in the world, he said. Each time he mentioned one of these freedoms, he would say, everywhere in the world. Though less memorable, President Bush's words yesterday could have been cut directly from the fabric of President Roosevelt's Four Freedoms Address. I think in particular of his ringing peroration, some of which lamentably was cut for the sake of time, but since it was the most eloquent part of the speech, I'm going to share it with you. You will have missed this, but it's worth remembering. When the Declaration of Independence was first read in public and the Liberty Bell was sounded in celebration, a witness said it rang as if it meant something. In our time, it means something still. America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom. The word freedom recurs in President Bush's speech 47 times. These words, idealistic to be sure, if out of the boilerplate of inaugural addresses passed, are worthy of a Roosevelt. Yet on the day after his most recent successor's inaugural address, in a time, I might add, of much greater general prosperity, we find ourselves so bitterly divided as a nation that this paean to freedom, one that could have been spoken as well by John F. Kennedy, leaves half a nation cynical and cold. It almost seems that our sturdy national motto, E pluribus unum, out of many one, may soon need updating to E pluribus duo, out of many, two. While stressing the values we hold in common, especially our reverence for freedom, again and again and again, President Bush did allude yesterday to the divisions in our nation. "We have known divisions," he said, "which must be healed to move forward in great purposes, and I will strive in good faith to heal them. Yet those divisions do not define America." Ideally, he's right. They don't. But actually, in two respects that I can think of, or that I was thinking about as I listened to his address, they do. We may all revere freedom. I trust we do. But the imposition of democracy is very different from the defense of democracy. Democracies imposed by force carry with them a high level of moral ambiguity. On this, especially in Iraq, the shadow of which was cast across the inaugural grounds, the nation remains bitterly divided. Second, couching freedom in religious terms, which Roosevelt and Kennedy did also, by the way, at a time when a great and growing religious divide defines early 21st century American politics, can't help but contribute, unintentionally to be sure, and perhaps without warrant, to the very divisions it is meant to heal. You will notice in the speech that every third time he mentioned freedom, he mentioned faith or religion or God. Political division in America, especially in election years, is nothing new, of course. I'm writing a book right now on religion and the early presidents, so I'm reminded of this on an almost daily basis. So let me begin with this suggestion. In addition to a deep breath, those of you who have been muttering ever since early November about leaving the country might dare to take a longer view. In 1800, Thomas Jefferson challenged President John Adams in our first vigorously contested election. It is, I can promise you this, the last time that two Unitarians ran against one another for the presidency of the United States. Here is what the Connecticut Current warned its readers to expect should Jefferson prevail. Murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will all be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of distress, the soil will be soaked with blood, and the nation black with crimes. For sheer viciousness, I can promise you, the Federalist and Republican broadsides of 1800 make last year's political ads seem like child's play in comparison. But, as I just said, last year's presidential election did highlight one division in our nation that has been growing in recent years, and to which I shall, as I promised Alan, devote the remainder of my time this evening, namely the chasm between those who view America through religious and through secular lenses. The former group, composed primarily of fundamentalists, conservative Catholics, and Protestant evangelicals, seeks moral resolution or restoration to the establishment, some would say reestablishment, of a Christian or, at the very least, a religiously instructed government. The latter, made up in large measure of mainline Protestants, liberal Catholics, and the growing population of citizens who openly describe themselves as secular or non-affiliated, cringes at the infusion of religion into politics and seeks to enhance and protect American pluralism by keeping our government, some would say nation, resolutely secular. One recent poll, a University of Akron survey on religion and politics, suggests the growing magnitude of this religion gap, greater by far than the gender gap ever was. On average, those Americans who attend church three times a month or more were almost twice as likely to support Bush over Kerry. Those who attend church two times a month or less supported Kerry by approximately the same margin, with the gulf widest at both ends of the church-going spectrum. The number of people who worship isn't growing, by the way. The religious constituency is changing. The mainline Protestant denominations are in sharp decline. Fundamentalist and evangelical churches, along with the Mormons, continue to grow apace. Overlooked by most commentators is another statistic. People who call themselves non-religious are increasing almost as rapidly as those who define themselves as born again. By one measure, over just the last decade, self-described secularists have grown from 10 to 17% of the population. Now, here's what scares me. Should this trend continue, we may end up one day with a religious and a secular party in America. Insensitive to protections that ensure church-state separation, the religious party, devoted to moral order and responsible freedom, would turn an increasingly blind eye to the first clause of the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. The second, or secular party, devoted to individual liberty and wary of religious interference, would likely prove as insensitive to the rights protected in the second clause of the very same amendment, which precludes Congress from making any law on religion prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Both sides, the fundamentalists on the right and on the left, tend to overlook an essential part of our national heritage. First, however much the devout secularists among us may wish it otherwise, ours is, has been, and for the conceivable future will continue to be a religious nation, in the broadest sense of that word. The nation's moral and spiritual grounding is one of America's essential, though often perverted, strengths. Our highest ideals are drawn from the sacred principles of liberty and equality that Jefferson spells out so eloquently in the Declaration of Independence. Grounded in the creation itself by nature and nature's God, this is a metaphysic, by the way, the founders' ideals held both themselves and do continue to hold succeeding generations under the judgment of a higher law. They also constitute the unum in E Pluribus Unum. By the same token, however much the most ideologically avid Christian may wish it otherwise, ours is a devoutly, and has from the beginning been established as a devoutly secular government. Freedom of conscience is rightly the first American liberty. Encompassing religious belief and disbelief, this liberty requires and has throughout our history been protected by a healthy measure of church-state separation. In conjunction with our other sacred liberties of press, speech, and assembly, freedom of and freedom from belief undergirds the pluribus of E Pluribus Unum. The last thing this nation needs is an unum party and a pluribus party. Neither alone fulfills the founder's vision. In either instance, the ultimate triumph of one over the other would lead to the rending of a fabric designed to serve us all. Religion will always have a place in our politics. Religious values are or should be moral values. They will instruct both our activism and our votes, whoever we are. It will instruct our activism and our votes. In fact, the three most biblically charged presidential campaigns in the nation's history were waged by progressive candidates. The populist, fundamentalist, and social gospel advocate William Jennings Bryan, 3 times. Theodore Roosevelt on the Bull Moose ticket in 1912, who proclaimed, "We stand at Armageddon and battle for the Lord." And this may surprise you, as I was reading back over the various campaign speeches of all the different candidates throughout our history, the third is George McGovern, whose rhetoric was infused with the prophetic proclamations of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Yet the churches themselves and other religious institutions must beware hitching their moral star to anyone's political wagon. From the outset of our experience in governance and by the conscious design of the founders, religion has thrived in America in large measure because the government was excluded from corrupting its franchise. Church-state separation is better described as freedom for religion, not freedom from religion. Because historically, whenever the church and state get in bed together, it's the church whose virtue is compromised. "Will you respect me in the morning?" she may well ask. The answer is almost always no. Just look at Europe. Look at England, where the Anglican Church has fed at the government trough for centuries. Or Sweden, where the Lutheran Church was disestablished only 4 years ago. Almost nobody goes to church. The United States of America is the most religious Western industrialized nation precisely because the church has maintained her moral independence and therefore her moral authority. For this very reason, church-state separation has long been championed by religious leaders in this nation and especially by evangelical Protestants. Less than half a century ago, when John F. Kennedy, a Roman Catholic, ran for president, many Protestant leaders were terrified. Some of you will remember. Why? Because of their mistaken apprehension that the Vatican would gain backdoor access to the White House if he were elected. Norman Vincent Peale and other more evangelical Protestant ministers sounded alarms that Kennedy, should he be true to his faith, would be forced to be answerable to the Pope and not to the people. This inspired, by the way, Adlai Stevenson, who was a Unitarian save when he ran for president, during which years he was a Presbyterian. To say, "I have always found the gospel of Paul to be appealing and the gospel of Peale to be appalling." Their panic was such that it didn't even escape the easily distracted attention of a 12-year-old boy. I recall the shock, living in Washington at the time, of receiving a quarter that someone had defaced with red nail polish by painting a cardinal's cap on George Washington's head. Eleanor Roosevelt, in the final volume of her 3-volume autobiography written shortly before her death, lamented the faithlessness powering such bigotry. What seemed to me most deplorable was not the fact that so many people feared the strength of the Roman Catholic Church, she said. It was that they had no faith in the strength of their own way of life and their own constitution. Even if Kennedy had turned out to be an undercover Vatican agent, Eleanor Roosevelt was confident, and she should have been, that our sturdy national tradition of church-state separation would protect the state from being shanghaied by the church. Many evangelical, particularly Protestant leaders, were less sanguine about the resiliency of church-state separation. Yet about one thing, almost everyone back then seemed to agree. In the United States of America, church-state separation is inviolable. How distant the day seems, and yet how recent it was that right-wing Christians rush more quickly to condemn the admixture of religion and politics than did left-wing secularists. As late as 1965, a young, pre-politicized Jerry Falwell anathematized the ministers who marched with Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, Alabama. Preachers are not called to be politicians, but to be soul winners, Falwell said. Especially in America's Protestant heartland, right here, concerns about the Catholic Church compromising Kennedy's political independence and jeopardizing the separation of church and state were so widespread that he had to tackle the problem right on. In Houston, speaking to the local ministers' association, he memorably proclaimed, "I'm not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me." Kennedy reinforced this promise with sentiments almost every one of his predecessors, from George Washington onward, could easily have ratified. "I would not look with favor," he said, "upon a president working to subvert the First Amendment's guarantees of religious liberty. Nor would our system of checks and balances permit him to do so. I believe in a president whose religious views are his own private affair, neither imposed by him upon the nation, or imposed by the nation upon him as a condition to holding that office." Now, how dramatically the political climate has shifted from that election to this. Back then, evangelical Protestants defamed John F. Kennedy for being a Catholic. Last year, Catholic leaders joined many evangelical Protestants to condemn Roman Catholic presidential candidate John Kerry for not being Catholic enough. According to the religious right, then and now, Kennedy's election would imperil the nation by bringing the Vatican into the White House. Kerry's would do the same by not bringing the Vatican into the White House. No longer deemed a bulwark essential to the protection of our liberties, church-state separation is viewed by many religious and political advocates today as almost un-American. Theodore Sorensen, who was at All Souls last night talking about the inaugural address and who assisted Kennedy in the penning of his Houston address, is quick to point out the irony. The denominational heirs to those who then expressed concern that Kennedy's religious views would influence his political decisions, and I'm now quoting what Sorensen said last night, now openly and expressly urge that their religious doctrines be favored over others, that their members in office set political public policies according to these religious doctrines, and that their political views be binding on their congregations. Today's Catholic hierarchy would be wise, I admit, to hold suspect any advice I might have to offer them. But I will say this. When a bishop chooses one tenet of his faith regarding abortion, say, and says that any Catholic who supports a pro-choice candidate is committing a sin, entirely apart from transgressing prudent laws that prohibit preachers mounting their pulpits to instruct their parishioners for whom to vote, it is clear that he is subordinating his religious to his political faith. Why is this clear? Because if he were not, he would go on to say that any Catholic who supports a candidate who is in favor of the death penalty, or who supported what the Pope condemned as an unjust war in Iraq, is also committing a sin. If Michael Bishop Sheridan of Colorado, or any of the other bishops who would deny both communion and the promise of salvation to a pro-choice Catholic, were charged to design a strategy to empty his church's pews as quickly as possible, this would surely be it. One final word about the danger of theologizing politics. All by itself, religion is perhaps the most divisive and dangerous force in the world today. True believers are forever incited first to damn and then sometimes to blow their infidel neighbors to the nether side of kingdom come. Most wars have been, to one extent or another, holy and therefore truly unholy wars. When augmented by the rhetoric of Armageddon, political gulfs, difficult enough to bridge to begin with, can quickly become political chasms. The people of this nation have a lot of work to do if we are to work together and not against one another, as President Bush suggested we must yesterday, to meet the challenges of our time, both foreign and domestic. There is more than a merely rhetorical distinction between disagreeing with one's neighbors, however, and demonizing them. Admitting how combustive this admixture of religion and politics can be, let me nonetheless leave you with precisely the opposite thought, that there may be, in fact, too little religion in our politics, not too much. Too little of the religion prescribed by the prophet Micah to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. Too little of the religion taught by Rabbi Jesus, who summed up all the law and the prophets in two great commandments: to love God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul, and your neighbor as yourself. Too little of the religion is defined by Thomas Jefferson, who said, "It is in our lives and not in our words that our religion must be read." Too little of the new frontier ethic, not to be served but to serve, most eloquently summed up in John F. Kennedy's own inaugural, when he reminded the American people that here on earth, God's work must truly become our own. Is it asking too much to hope for just a little more of this kind of religion in politics? I pray not. I pray that we may yet rise to the challenge our founders set before us. E pluribus unum, a union of faith and freedom, in which faith elevates freedom, yet freedom tempers faith. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. We have... You are very, very kind. Thank you for that. I'm happy to answer questions, and we have microphones here, so everybody can hear your questions. So if you raise your hand and...
We'll kind of rotate, try to take one question from each section, if you have questions.
This is a group of many Unitarian Universalists, right? There must be questions. Yes.
So I'm not quite sure where you're coming down on George Bush. Are you feeling... Are you feeling that we're all overreacting at being terrified by this man? Or do you feel that we're justified in our fear, in other words?
Well, you know, I'm guilty sometimes of what might be called better living through rationalization. And I always look for hope. I find it to be part of the universalist fabric. Another part of the universalist fabric is that, remember, everyone gets saved. And it's very important for us to remember that. If we get involved, and you have to divide the person from the sin, as our fundamentalist friends are very quick to say when they excoriate one of their brothers or sisters for something that they can't stand. But dividing the individual from the sin, all I'm saying about that inaugural address is that the words themselves paint a universal picture, much of which is right on theme to our highest ideals. The practice, however, that is behind those words is often at divergence with their essence. When you talk, as he did, about the importance of human dignity and human rights and women's rights, and how important it is for us to model this and preach it and encourage it and fight for it and win it all around the world, and then forget that Saudi Arabia, say, or Pakistan, stay with Saudi Arabia for a moment, is one of our principal allies, where women's rights are non-existent, you can't even drive a car, where there is nothing at all resembling this vision of freedom that he is offering. It's clear that we have a much more cynical, realpolitik kind of policy that is absolutely at divergence from the edifying and, in many degrees, potentially redemptive words that he uses. And if there is cynicism around the world and in this country in response to this address of freedom that was missing when the American people responded to Franklin Roosevelt's call for freedom, it's not the words, it's the subtext that leads to the dissonance and leads to the cynicism. I do think that the dream and the vision and the ideal is a profound one, and one which we should not reject simply because a person with whom we differ profoundly politically, as many I expect of us here today do, we should not reject the vision or the dream. But we must at the same time remember that the true patriot is one who recalls us to the better angels of our nature and helps to call this nation itself under judgment, not just other nations in the world selectively, in order to impose our will. That's where I would come down on what I consider to be a fundamentally well-intentioned but false speech. Other thoughts? Questions?
In your book, The Separation Between Church and State, you point out that Jefferson very presciently acknowledged that even though in his present circumstance they could legislate this, in the future they wouldn't have any control over what Congress might do. And these days that sort of prediction seems to be coming to pass, and the deck seems to be stacked increasingly against the very system of checks and balances that we have, you know, depended on. What sort of defense do we have against this? How can we stop it?
Well, first of all, we're not as far down the road as we may in our alarm feel we might be. This is much of the reason that the right wing has gotten so politically, right wing religious folks have gotten so involved politically, is in response to a whole series of congressional actions and court decisions that place their own values in what they claim to be their values and are their values in jeopardy. And that has yet, that there is a current, there is a tide welling against that, but that tide has not yet broken the rather sturdy dike that is established. However, the best response for those who would make sure that their liberties be preserved is to respond with as much activism, as much real present alarm and sense of concern and even sense of danger, as you suggest, as those on the right continue to evince. There is still an enormous amount of paranoia in the heartland of this country about the liberal takeover of America and the American mores and the American ethos and American values. And one can dismiss that, but to be fair, we have drifted in the direction of becoming a more secular nation. We're now, however, drifting in the direction of having a more religious government. Initially, we had, and the founders approved of, a rather religious nation and quite a secular government. Those two things are almost going in this direction, which is why it's a complicated issue and cannot just be tossed off as saying, you know, this side's right, this side's wrong. But I do think, for instance, that the moment that Roe v. Wade gets placed into jeopardy, you're going to have four times the number of people actively involved in protecting their own rights as you have today. And that will prove to be the genius of democracy, I believe. I don't believe the democratic system is in any jeopardy whatsoever. I think we're more democratically engaged now than we've been in a long, long time. Unfortunately, for those who share my particular political views, which I don't preach from the pulpit, but my political views, the democracy is all-encompassing, and it is not just democratically activated those people with whom I agree, it is also democratically activated those people with whom I disagree. This is evidently, to me, this is not a terrible thing. The balance is very close. This is actually not a red and blue nation, as the map puts it. Most of the nation, every part of it is split really, really close and really, really tightly. But we do have to be vigilant to defend for religion's sake as well as for morality's sake, these fundamental and what I would call sacred virtues that in the name of moral order are placed today, I think, in some jeopardy. For all of the talk of freedom in that address, I think the one quality that is most neglected by this particular administration is liberty itself.
Yeah, I wondered if you could say a few words about faith-based charities. I know that's been one of the hallmark of President Bush's. You know, is this a slippery slope? Is the devil in the details? Certainly we have a long faith tradition of ourselves of social action, social witness.
Sure.
Say something about that, please. Thank you.
It's a great question. I'll give you an example. My own personal experience of faith-based initiatives before they became popular. One day, about 12 years ago, I received a $10,000 check in the mail from my local state assemblyman, which could be put toward the New York State check cut to All Souls Church for the use of our soup kitchen, Mana from Albany. And I discovered, I was curious. This doesn't happen all the day, all the time. It was nice to receive $10,000 unsolicited in the mail. But I was curious about this, and so I called the assemblyman's office, and he said that he'd given it to 12 religious institutions in the district as part of his members' money, which is basically a kind of sophisticated walking around money that they give themselves to provide direct support of their constituents and ensure their re-elections. But so I found out where the other churches that had received this in synagogues, and I called them all up and said, well, let's all get together and turn this money back. Wouldn't that be great? And what do you know? It was just, they couldn't have agreed with me more, but there was just no way they practically could do it because, you know, the board had just met the night before and they weren't going to meet until next month and they didn't have the authorization to do this and they weren't sure where the check was. And so I just gave the money back by myself and hogged all of the credit. But I'll tell you why I did it. And I explained it then and I thought, absolutely quixotically and unsuccessfully to end this stupid budgeting system that Albany has. But I could have taken that $10,000 and given it to our soup kitchen, just exactly as it was intended. And then I could have freed $10,000 from our soup kitchen budget and helped to pay for our new member welcoming coordinator, namely our front line evangelist. And it would just have been a little bladder of laundering money. If they had cared to ask, which they didn't seem to want to do, if I had spent that money properly, I would have been able to point out that it was right there in the soup kitchen budget. This money is so fungible. Temptations are so great. That's the first concern I have. Who's going to do the due diligence on all of this? Hundreds, actually thousands, tens of thousands of congregations receiving $25,000, $50,000 money. We're talking about $1.5 billion that was given away last year. This is all sort of under the radar screen, not approved by Congress on executive order. So that is the first concern. The second concern I have is that what happens to religious independence when your largest contributor is your local congressperson? And that's the way it works. You end up getting this by getting the imprimatur of your congressperson who says, yes, Reverend Church is a splendid fellow and that soup kitchen's a splendid soup kitchen, and then it goes through particular if your congressman is of the right party, you'll go through the red tape and you'll get your money. It's hard enough, and ministers in the audience will understand this, it's hard enough to maintain one's integrity with some member of the congregation who gives you $50,000 in a given year. Blessedly, most such people are very, very undemanding and just so grateful to be able to give, and they know their soul's been saved, so it's just fine. But you know, you just cringe that the day will never come when that person who's your biggest giver says, by the way, you know, you're preaching a little bit too much on this this Iraq problem. I think you better stop. I think that's about time to stop that, don't you? And you'll say, well, maybe it is about time. I took a little break from Iraq, if that's what you say. Or maybe it's time to take a little break from the $50,000. And the same thing would go if your major contributor happened to be the let's say, the President of the United States and your local congressperson. That's the second concern I have. The third concern is that the faith-based initiative is completely cynical. It's an absolutely cynical smokescreen for the dismantling of the government welfare system. There are problems with that system, I know. But believe me, this was not designed by religious conservatives. This was designed by hard-wing ideologues who were looking for ways to deconstruct the federal welfare system by distributing its offices into the community. And that there are so many ways in which this basically just doesn't work. I am confident that there'll be a test case within 2 years that will involve a major misuse of money, that will involve a clear stepping over even the blurred lines that have been established for the use of this money, and that will go all the way to the Supreme Court. And I believe if the present Supreme Court, certainly, and I think you have to have two changes before this would change, and these are not predictable changes, as much as we may fear, that the faith-based initiatives will be proved unconstitutional. It's already so close to being unconstitutional that I can't tell you. Now, does that mean that there should not be major money given to Protestant welfare agencies and Catholic charities and groups that do major housing as it traditionally has been? No, it doesn't mean that at all. These are social service organizations that do not have congregations attached. There's no problem with that in my mind. We shouldn't be silly about saying because you're religious you can't help out and you can't benefit from the government programs that are designed to have citizen action groups implement their distribute their funds. That's not a problem. It's not the religious thing per se or the religious identification. It really is the blurring of the congregation and the evangelism dimension. And I worry about the church and I worry about the state. It's a tough one because goodness knows there are a lot of people who could use that money, and a lot of folks in the inner city who would be getting that money would be doing fine things with it. But I really believe that the faith-based initiative, for the reasons I've said and several others, is not the way to go.
Hello.
Yes.
I benefited from your soup kitchen, except it was breakfast on Sunday.
Oh,
and
good.
I compliment you on conducting that activity. You talked earlier about wars and that many of these have happened because of religious differences, or maybe the religious differences were used as the basis of the wars. We have here in Oak Park a major focus on interfaith discussion, and a group of 11 local people who are prominent religiousists were invited to Turkey, where they went and spent several weeks. Our local, but this brings to the table the whole issue of an interfaith initiative. We are now global in many ways, and I wonder why we're not becoming more global in terms of addressing interfaith initiatives. One of the messages that was brought back from Turkey, which is where these folks visited, was they visited the town where Abraham spent most of his life. And here we have Christianity, Judaism, but also Islam. So I wonder if you could comment on where you see this going, and do we have any hope that interfaith initiatives are going to lead us to normalize the tendencies toward these tensions that seem to pop up every now and then to lead to these great tragedies?
I, first of all, I'm glad you went to Turkey. I think that that's a splendid, any kind of interfaith work is vital today, because you can begin to build little bridges that we can all cross to one another. The interfaith work has got to move beyond, however, the nicey-nicey stuff that goes on saying we all believe in the same God and we all have the same faith. It's just simply not true. And the Abrahamic covenant approach is a useful one for the three faiths you mentioned, because you can go back to Abraham, although the three faiths go back to Abraham and each in very different ways. I think that interfaith dialogue will grow up when everyone around the table begins to openly discuss their own terrorist texts. Every scripture has terrorist texts, not just Islam. Judaism has terrorist texts. Christianity, I come not to bring peace to the earth but a sword. I come to divide son from father and mother-in-law from daughter-in-law. It is in the scripture. It has babies cast against rocks right after the poor in Jerusalem are wailing for their losses in the most lamentable way, and Rachel is crying, and then all of a sudden the enemy's baby is dashed against the rocks. It's very important for us to begin to own our own complicity in the world's terror. Now, I think if we were to dare in our interfaith dialogues to be something other than just nicey-nicey, we would begin to own the extent to which the most powerful and redemptive force in the world is also the most demonic and destructive. And only then can these be something other than social coffee clatches without much and joint Thanksgiving services without much purchase on our future. We have to acknowledge and own and answer religion's accountability and organized religion's accountability to today's divisiveness, horror, and terror.
Francisco, so we'll continue with that for the moment at least.
Between, say the baby boomer generation, especially the younger ones who are 20 now, and how you might recharacterize or highlight what you said based on generational differences.
The baby boomer generation, which I'm sort of right smack in the middle of, is the imperialist generation. Basically, I call it the pig and the snake. You know the old one, when a snake eats, the python eats pig. You can watch the python move through the pig. You know, notice those little pictures of the python is this far and it's this far. Basically, and it's interesting, you go back to the 1950s when the pig was a kid, that was the decade of churches and education. And then the 60s when the pig is an adolescent is the day of social unrest and rioting and the rebellion in the streets, and then than the pig in the 70s and 80s is in its 20s. It's the me decade, the greed decade. The pig is out for itself, just basically nosing in its own sty. And then you go on, and the pig begins to have children, and you have the rediscovery of morality and the new kind of boomlet of community and everything. And now the pig's getting old. And yes, the pig is thinking about his or her children or grandchildren, but the pig, being fundamentally a selfish creature and a fallen human, is also particularly in great numbers thinking very much about him or herself. And that places us at a very, very vulnerable place with almost every other generation. If this the way you know this imperialist thing is going on, by the way, have you ever thought about what oldies are? You know, the oldies? Well, in the 60s, oldies were 50s songs. In the 70s, they were 50s and 60s songs. In the 80s, they were 50s and 60s and 70s songs. In the 90s, they were 50s and 60s songs. Early 70s songs. Basically, when I was growing up, oldies were not 40s songs. Absolutely not. There weren't enough 40s people still around to impose that kind of imperialism upon our culture. So it's a huge, huge problem. One really has to get completely outside of one's own head to answer the question that you've just posed me. I can tell you I have four 20-somethings in my own family. And I have great sympathy for any others of you out there who are in exactly the same magnificent and joyous predicament that I am. But they do have a very... and. It's hard for me to generalize because each of them has such a distinct view on the world, but it's very different from my own. And the one thing that I see lacking in three of the four of my children is even the beginnings of idealism. They are not bad people. They are not civically unminding people, but they are far from being idealistic. There is a cynicism that has settled in, and there is a the things that used to inspire a group of us together about our nation, say, will not inspire this group. Now that could be good. There could be a kind of a resistance to a patriotic cant that comes from that, an independence of mind that comes from it. But at the same time, there is a kind of a sad quality of I won't call it hopelessness, simply unaccountability, irresponsibility, lack of engagement. How that began to turn around, I think, in this last election, and it happened not just in one party; it happened in both. Never have we had more young people actively engaged, in my memory, since the 60s. That's a very very, very positive sign. The question is whether they end up believing that their work is going to be, its gains will justify its efforts. I don't know that that's where everyone has to collaborate and cooperate. I'm not sure that that's what you're asking for, but it is a free associated answer.
With President Bush, it feels like a lot of the times what he seems to feel is moral, I feel is immoral, and vice versa. And I'm wondering why we don't hear more from the left and moderates saying it's immoral to have so many poor people. It's immoral to et cetera, et cetera. Why isn't the religious movement on the left and the middle saying more to combat some of this stuff on the right?
Well, it's a good question if the premise is correct. I'm not certain that this is not. Goodness knows, if you go to a Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, You will certainly hear again and again and again the invocations of the, what we call a higher morality or a justice morality. I, by the way, do believe that all of us, if asked the question, what is our number one priority as we come out of the voting booth or go into the voting booth, I think the answer should be moral values. I do think that's the answer. The problem with the moral values discussion now is there are too few moral values in play, and they're in too small of a box. And so it is our responsibility to, as you suggest, expand the moral values. Let's just take a look at the rhetoric here. Which word has more power, life or choice? Life has a lot more resonating power than choice. So I now say I'm pro-life. I won't let anyone take that away from me. I am not opposed, however, to a woman's right to choose in terms of abortion. I'm pro-life because I look at life in a large, large way. I don't look at it as from up to birth. I look at it from birth on to death. I look at all of the ways in which life is affected by our policies and programs, prenatal care, education, health care for the poor, basic quality of living and standard of living for the poorest among us, all of the issues that do define what life is for our citizens should be in our purview if we are truly to call ourselves pro-life. At times you have to do triage. At times you have to do triage, and you have to say, you know, that there's going to be a greatest good, and you're going to have to do something that you wish you didn't have to do. But we really have to reclaim. I wrote a little book called God and Other Famous Liberals once, Reclaiming Bible, Flag, and Family from the Religious Right. And I really do think that it's a failure of our imagination not to be able to reclaim the high symbols and reclaim the rhetoric, to simply allow others to take the flag and the Bible and the family and life and hold it in their small captivity is a tragedy. We must redeem those, reclaim them, hold them up, support them and defend them in the highest way we possibly can. That another person should betray those trusts doesn't mean that we should abandon them. What time is it, Al? 29. Let's do a couple more questions. One more question. Okay, I can't see anything.
I've got one.
The lights are in my eyes.
Over here.
Yeah, there you are. There's a shadow over here. Yes.
I'll stay in the shadows. Thank you. Much of the discussion tonight and much of the discussion nationally has to do with religious right, religious moderates, religious left.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, and this actually this does not really encompass merely Christianity. It encompasses religious moderate Islam, fundamentalist Islam. Go down the list. All of it assumes a belief in God and belief that the sacred text, whatever it is in fact God-given and inviolable. And there are people, and I am one of them, who say, you know what? If you read all of it, it's really nonsense. It is inconsistent. It is wildly contradictory. If you believed it, you would have to cast yourself into the fire. And so I say, I am not a believer in it. I am not a deist. I do not believe in a personal God, but I believe in justice, mm-hmm. and I believe that such things are fundamental. They are basic to humanity, irrespective of the writings, irrespective of the belief, irrespective of how you address your God. And this, there are many. And that whole population is irrelevant in this.
Well, that's a great question to close on. It was very, very eloquently stated. First of all, as I said, the group who is willing to stand up and say exactly what you said has grown almost by double in the last decade. So there is a growing number of self-proclaimed secularists and non-affiliated. Second, those going back, and as I mentioned, all the way to the founders, the separation of church and state, even when there were very few people, Thomas Paine, for instance, was himself not an atheist, though he was certainly branded as such. So there were very few who would fall in the category that you're describing. Nonetheless, that was taken into account in our not only First Amendment, but also all of the discussions that led up to that, namely that there would be freedom of religion and freedom from religion as part of our sacred covenant. And indeed, that was considered to be a sacred covenant. Now, going back to the first statement you made, whenever anyone tells me that he or she doesn't believe in God, I always ask them to tell me a little about the God they don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in him either. There is no question that most of what passes as theology, and historically has been sustained and taught as theology, is, if you blink at it twice, balderdash. There's no question about that. The question is whether we're talking science here or talking poetry. For me, I mean, I consider religion to be, we're the religious animal. Religion's our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. We, since we're going to die, we question what life means. Some of our answers may have a God in them, some of them may not. We struggle to find our way. There are 1.7 trillion stars in the known universe for every living human being, that we can sit on this tiny little rock in this strange part of the cosmos and argue over who has the best insider information on the Creator and the creation is utterly bewildering to me. So I don't think that in general we're going to disagree very much. God for me is just, it's just the biggest word I know. I call it that which is greater than all and present in each. It doesn't add a cubit to my stature to disbelieve in someone else's tiny God. What I need to do is figure out how to see my own tears in another person's eyes. How to recognize that which holds us, and it's very much what you're talking about, these eternal laws of justice, say, of love and goodness. These things are all part of our rent fabric, which we struggle one generation after the next to sew together as best we can. The essence to universalism, as I understand it, is the recognition that mysteriously born, we recognize that we're all fated to die. The same sun sets on each of our horizons. The mortar of mortality binds us fast to one another. We are so much more alike in every way than we differ. I mean, in every way that matters, than we differ in ways that we recognize. Whether it be our religion, whether it be our skin color, whether it be our beliefs, whether it be our politics, fundamentally we are so much more alike. We are even much more alike in our ignorance than we differ in our knowledge. We are also profoundly and cosmically ignorant, which is a great, great sort of encouragement to humility when one is sure that one is right and another is wrong. The very fact that we're here debating the question is so absolutely mind-blowing that we should stop for a minute and say, whoa, this is moving, this is too strange, I can't believe that I'm talking and you're listening and we're all thinking and this is a magnificent room, this is just stranger than, not only stranger than we imagined, but stranger than can be imagined. This is a very strange thing. Now, given all of that, our obligation, and this is where universalism is redemptive, is to craft a large enough faith and faithfulness that it includes the other rather than excludes the other. It's a very, very, very high bar. It's very hard to do. And we're not doing it when we simply reject the other. We are doing it when we say, your metaphor and mine don't quite go together, but I'm not going to fight over that. I'm going to fight with you wherever I can, but I'm not going to allow you to do certain things that will jeopardize our common good. I will try to think for the larger good as best I can. It's like this world is a vast cathedral, and there are millions and millions of windows, and they're all very different, and we only have a tiny amount of time to look at the light shining through one or two or three of them during our lifetime and understand what it all means. You got some folks see the light shining through their window, and they say, this is the only window through which the light shines. And those same folks will sometimes tell their followers to go out and throw stones through other people's windows. And that's when we say no stone throwing in the cathedral. There are also people who are walking through this bewildering cathedral with the unbelievable variety of worshipers and windows. They look around and they conclude there is no light. In my view, the windows aren't the light. They're where the light shines through. I don't care what you call it. It doesn't matter whether you call it justice or whether you call it God. But there is something absolutely magical and numinous and unaccountable and divine which I revere. And I just hate to see it trampled, particularly in the name of God and in the name of good and in the name of morality, in the dust. And that's why I commit myself, and people in our congregations, I believe, commit themselves week in and week out to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with their God under whatever name. Thank you very much.